sometimes it seems like kind of a shame to break the silence with words. The peacefulness and quiet of the meditation, the evening, the beauty of the paritta chanting that we did this evening. Sometimes I think that says enough. But maybe a few words to just help keep the community focused and going along with our practice for this winter retreat. Bit of a break between our rainstorms here, another one coming in, I think, a little bit later this evening. But a day of stillness in that area, just the water flowing in the creeks. Kind of a subdued atmosphere, partly cloudy or overcast. All the signals pointing towards staying inside. We've been doing readings this past week along the lines of mindfulness. This Dhamma is for one who is mindful, not for one who is muddle-minded. And sometimes the discussion and the the teachings themselves, you know, and for good reason, can get a bit, we get quite focused on terms and meanings and trying to get a bit of a conceptual grasp on this, to be able to take it in, to turn inwards with it, and to use those concepts to point towards an experience. Sometimes it can get a little bit technical or dry or methodical, talking about the method. And just always wanting to remind ourselves to keep pointing back towards the heart, towards the citta, towards the experience, towards the transformation of our minds to realize the truth of the teachings directly, to be brought in directly for experience, to realize the goal of the teachings, the inevitable goal. If we keep moving with the path and keep walking the path, the goal of complete liberation. And just keeping on bringing it in, opanaiko, to be brought in. And sometimes just a few recollections that we can bring to, you know, move from the concept to the experience, the more heartfelt kinds of recollections. Ajahn Titipaño talked about some of these four protective meditations that he brought up in his talk on the last one prat. One of the first one was the Buddha Nusati, recollection of the Buddha. And that with the other two refuges, the recollection of Dhamma, recollection of Sangha, are, you know, three very important recollections to help inspire not so conceptually difficult to understand but recollections that inspire and open the heart, bring us back in, rather than just trying to learn the other aspects of the teaching. These are recollections that help us to settle and experience the true nature of our being. Because they uplift the mind, they uplift the heart. I thought I'd spend just a few minutes talking about Dhamma and Sangha as refuges. Ajahn Titipaño did a magnificent job of the recollection of the Buddha. So in the recollection of Dhamma, Dhammanicity, it's a crucial thing to bring up for consideration, and really to recognize that in the Buddhist teaching, he really didn't just talk about Dhamma. He talked about Dhamma Vinaya. He referred to his teaching using that double hyphenated word Dhamma Vinaya, not just the Dhamma, the teaching and the training, teaching and the discipline. Because it's a multifaceted approach that he taught. I think so much of what we think of when we think of Dhamma practice is from how we've experienced it as it has become established, of course, in the West and in Asian countries now as well, in terms of receiving teachings and practicing meditation within retreat centers or Dhamma centers, they sometimes called retreat centers, so that the emphasis on the practice in these settings is one of the mind training, the practice of meditation, and somewhat teachings on some of the right view aspects of the Buddhist teaching. And of course, there's always reference to, not always, but frequently reference in these places to the aspect, some of the other aspects of the teachings from the Buddha, like sila, the five precepts, things like that. But it's fairly rare outside of monasteries to get the full-on day-to-day reminding of the entirety of the path that the Buddha taught, the Dhamma Vinaya, and how important that fullness, that scope is for the full realization of the path. This is not a quick, easy practice if we're intent on liberation, full liberation, realizing the entirety of the truths. If we want to walk the path to completion, then it's a long-term commitment, as the Dalai Lama is noted for having said with strong emotion, there is no fast, there is no easy. If there were a faster, easier way, don't you think I would teach that? So there's for people who are inspired by the teachings and want to go the full length, there is this teaching and this training that work together, work hand in hand, mutually supportive. The most obvious way that, training supports the teaching aspect of something we talk about all the time, the sila, the precepts, particularly the moral precepts that everybody, lay or monastic, endeavors to follow, the precepts of non-harming. Essentially, that's the orientation of non-harming. not taking life, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not engaging in false speech, false or harmful speech, not taking intoxicants that alter the mind state to carelessness. Particularly the first four as moral precepts in and of themselves. And we reflect often how that is a basis for a settled, contented mind that is more malleable and ready to delve to deeper levels and see the truths of the creation of suffering and how we can follow a path to the end of suffering. So it creates that. It influences how we can practice Dhamma, obviously. Talk about that quite a bit. And we can see how also it works in the reverse direction. The practices that we do to reflect on non-harming, say, metta bhavana, metta practice, we've been talking about that a fair amount also. That kind of specific recollection, mind training, if you will, heart training of picking up perceptions of goodwill, of kindness, of wishing well to all creatures, developing that perception and bringing it into the heart and experiencing it and knowing what it feels like, actually, the actual nimitta of metta, that sense of gentle appreciation, that gentle well-wishing, a warmth, and a wish for the happiness of others, all creatures. How that, just reflecting on that, establishing that, developing that, expanding on that, how that then informs our conduct. You know, the mind that's well established in goodwill doesn't want to harm other creatures, doesn't want to take advantage of people, and that the development of that perception, that quality, supports the precepts. So they work together. We hold them both simultaneously, and this is how, like, Dhamma and Vinaya work together to support each other. Kind of on a more refined level, a lot of the monastic training around etiquette also serves the same purpose. And this training is emphasized very much in this monastic tradition. And you see actually elements of it too in some of the teachings sometimes and from some of the other lay practitioners in terms of developing mindfulness in daily activities, scrupulously bringing to mind and watching what we're doing when we're doing it, trying to attune to present moment activities as a way of not getting lost in the past, getting lost in projections of the future. The monastic training, whether it's for ordained people in the monastery or the lay people who live in the monastery or spend time at the monastery, is very much geared towards that, as exemplified particularly in the Sakya training rules, training on etiquette, but also woven in all throughout many of the other aspects of the monastic training here in the monastery. And it's designed to help stabilize the mind from wandering and to develop a sense of mindfulness, but not just mindfulness of what we're doing, but mindfulness of what we're doing in this moment so that we can see more clearly how craving, clinging, identification, all of these things that are the root causes of suffering, how those arise in the present moment when we attend inappropriately. So it's got an overall, overarching purpose, even beyond just being in the moment. We're not practicing mindfulness to enjoy the fullest of the pleasures that can arise in any particular moment. We're practicing this moment-to-moment mindfulness so that we can see how it is that suffering arises and how suffering ceases in work towards developing that kind of relinquishment by seeing how it all happens. So even the small things like the etiquette training, we have just to develop this sensitivity to what's going on in the mind. It's not just for the sake of, you know, establishing a community standard and living by rules so that we all conform and don't get on each other's nerves too much. It's actually a mind training. I've heard it said sometimes that even if your, you know, meditation is just, you know, totally messed up and not working and going poorly, and you don't have a even a finger snap moment of peace, as it said in that one Theragata poem, that just following the monastic training, following the precepts, trying to follow the 227 precepts and all of their derivative rules, that in itself is a very, very comprehensive practice of mindfulness. Having to remember all the details about things like how you walk through town. You know, some of our training rules, walking through town, we try and keep our gaze somewhat focused in front of us. There are rules against, etiquette rules against kind of swinging our head, looking in windows, you know, look over there, you know, those kinds of things. We compose ourselves, we restrain ourselves in the way we walk. We don't swing our arms all around, we don't wag our head all around, we walk with a kind of a measured mindfulness. And that, those kinds of things result in a real peaceful state of mind. You can actually see the effect. It's not just for the sake of how we look, although that's kind of, you know, a nice thing too, to present a kind of a composed image to the rest of the world. But watching the effect that it has on the mind, it doesn't get stirred up, agitated by all the sights and sounds that can exist, particularly when one's going around in town. So we have very, very specific, very detailed rules about how to comport oneself, how to put on the robes that we wear when we go into town versus the ones that we have to use in the monastery. Very detailed mindfulness training. You know, even things like, you know, not putting our hands on our hips, arms akimbo, looks casual, too sloppy. We don't kind of, you know, how we dress, what we wear, we don't wear hats when we're on alms round, things like that. All these things, having to remember them really help compose the mind. How we eat, lots of rules around the eating, proportions of different kinds of foods that we should take, or you know, there are training rules about how much food to put on a spoon, not too much, not too little, just to get the right size of a mouthful, so that we're not stuffing out our cheeks, or, you know, taking little sips at a time. The sounds we make, we can't make you know, slurping sounds or things like that with our food. You know, how much food to take, time of day that we can eat, all of these things. Some people will say, oh, these are just really nitpicky rules that don't really have much effect, but just remembering them and practicing them and seeing the effect again that it has on the mind in and of themselves. These are mind training. And so there's lots of rules like that that all of us in the monastery are encouraged to follow and to see the effect that it has in terms of reducing that scattered attention. It's so easy to get just lost in all the experiences of the senses, whether we're wandering around in town and captivated by whatever's in the shop windows or the scenes on the street, or whether we're eating our food and getting lost in, I'll have some of that, you know, even are encouraged to even eat methodically so that we're not just constantly hunting around and picking at different things, you know, that our preferences tell us to go for. So all of these injunctions, all of these rules help settle the mind, bring it from a scattered to a focused state where we can see our cravings arise. What is it that attracts our attention? What is it that moves the mind? Whether it's in the realm of sights, sounds, tastes, smells, whatever. Also, in terms of the mind training, a lot of the rules that we study and work on, and whether or not they end up being violation of precepts, has to do with a very strong internal quality that we have to pay attention to. That of intention forms the basis for whether there is an infraction or not in many of the rules. So we not only have to learn the actual action itself that is part of the rule, but we also have to look at what the intention is, because sometimes when you do a certain action, it's a violation of a rule, and other times it's not. It depends on the intention. You know, like a simple example of saying something that is not true. You know, if your intention was not to deliberately deceive another person, but you still said something that was untrue, but it wasn't intended to deceive, then it's not a violation. It's not a breaking a precept. And that is a simple example of the aspect of intention that is present in many of the rules. So it's really a training in really examining one's internal motivations when we act through greed or aversion or confusion, and we see that our intention was not wholesome and we break a rule, then we have to confess that in some way. If we look internally and we examine and we see that it wasn't based on one of those states of mind, one of those more defiled states of mind, and that it was maybe more of an unconscious slip, or based on a different perception or different motivation, then it may not necessarily be a problem. So it forces us, following these rules and examining them and learning them and taking on this training, really highlights a lot of the inner workings of the mind along the lines of intention. And intention is where we create kamma. When we act on intention, whether it's through speech or bodily action or even thought itself, when there's an unwholesome base that's motivating us to express ourselves in one of those three ways, then we're creating kamma for ourselves, creating negative kamma that we have to experience the results of. So the Vinaya, the training, highlights and provides kind of a sphere where we can see this happening. It's a very strong, strong mind training. Our environment, you know, in the monastery, we're encouraged to take care of our environment, and that has a great effect on our state of mind as well. So we try and keep things clean. That's part of our core wat here at Abhayagiri and in the Thai forest tradition. We do try and keep our requisites neat and tidy. And we try and keep our work areas clean, and you know, it's, you can see what it's like or in our kutis where we live, you know, what the different effect that has when we are attentive towards simplification, reduction of requisites. You know, what do our spaces look like? Our living spaces, our workspaces, are they, you know, is the workshop cluttered, messed up, you know, tools lying all over the place, or have we left things out at work sites thinking that we're going to get to them someday and forget about them? I remember at another monastery I was staying at, I had some duties and oftentimes would be walking through forest areas and see somebody who had their own special project that had been going on for months and leaving tools out, getting rusty, things like that. So how we care for our requisites, how we live in our living spaces or our workspaces is it's a real opportunity for training the mind, keeping things clean, orderly, neat, simple, well looked after. These all have an effect on the mind. How we look after our requisites. And that also brings up a sense of appreciation, because all of everything that we have here has been given to us. We can experience a sense of gratitude respond likewise by using them well, taking care of them well, and to see what when we reflect on that, how does that make the mind feel? Settled, peaceful, contented, all qualities that lead us on the path. And the more we practice and reflect on those things, then the mind starts to actually want less. The interest in acquisition, getting the latest whatever, starts to become less, and you start to realize that sometimes the more complicated things are, the more burdensome they are. I was just reflecting on that earlier with the fact that our brand new Ford F-250 pickup truck has a glitch in the thermometer. It sometimes sticks on 32 degrees. So, you know, a digital readout, and there's probably something wrong somewhere in some little computer connection or wire connection or something like that. And it's sort of like, okay, well, now we got to think. Oh, you got to take it into the shop at some time. It's still under warranty. Can we take it into the local dealer? Do we have to take it back to where we bought it? You know, and the old truck didn't even have a thermometer in it. I don't even actually really care what the outside temperature is when I'm riding in the truck. But, you know, it's sort of like, okay, well, the more complicated things get, the more we bring into our lives along those kinds of things, then the more we have to spend trying to take care of them, to sort them out. And we can do that, you know, with reflection and realize that we can create or not create suffering over anything. And of course, a truck thermometer is a pretty minor thing that we have to suffer with. So that's good for reflection in and of itself, but it doesn't incline me towards wanting to complicate my life any more than I have to. So, yeah, just this kind of back and forth of as we develop our minds, then, you know, it actually becomes more of an inclination to follow the rules as we've gotten them. They start to actually make a lot of sense, how they support the development of mind, and how the development of mind in turn supports the way we operate in the world. It's often said that, you know, the way that we follow these Padimokkha rules, the training of the monastics, is actually the natural outcome or the natural result of the mind in its awakening process. So Dhamma and Vinaya working together, the Dhamma and the discipline training. And again, it doesn't have to be just limited to the monastery. There's, of course, some rules in the monastic training that don't make sense out in the world. You gotta handle money, pay the bills, and do things like that on a more practical level. But there are lots and lots of aspects of the refinements of the monastic discipline that sincere lay practitioners can bring into their lives. Just takes a bit more independent resolve without the support, the day-to-day support of actually taking on these precepts in a monastery. But they're there for that purpose. Taking refuge in Dhamma also for me means, you know, really taking time to recollect and reflect on the fullness of where the teachings can take us, and I just, you know, feel so awe-inspired sometimes by what one human being, the Buddha, who realized this path and this the results from this path on his own, and then formulated these teachings and this training. You know, just the incredible comprehensiveness of it, and the incredible level of detail and clarity of this teaching and training. It's, you know, it's almost incomprehensible how amazing it is, and that it also points to and leads to this possibility of complete liberation. The Buddha doesn't spend huge amounts of time trying to describe the goal of the practice, but using certain concepts and certain words to point somewhere where concepts and words don't apply, just to give a sense of direction to liberation, complete liberation, nibbana. There's a number of descriptions, descriptors that the Buddha uses to give us a hint or a taste. But to just even reflect on those, a reflection called, you know, the recollection of the peace of nibbana is encouraged. Upasama nusati, reflection on the perception of peace, complete peace. And the fact, and remembering the fact that this is the possibility. You know, we're not doing this just for the sake of a bit more ease in the mind, less neurotic behavior, although those are wonderful results of the practice. But remembering, reflecting that what the Buddha experienced, what he taught, what thousands more Arhat disciples realized, is that there is a complete ending to suffering that is possible. He says this Dhammavinaya, he actually uses the word Dhammavinaya, this Dhammavinaya, like the great ocean. Like the great ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, this Dhammavinaya has one taste, the taste of freedom, the taste of liberation. One of my favorite short recollections to help bring this perception up is one that most people are probably familiar with. This is peaceful, this is sublime, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, ceasing, nibbana. And then just to roll those words and their effect in the mind to help establish that perception of peace, the peace of release, the stilling of all formations, where the mind that creates new karmic formations, the stilling of that force based the stilling of all intentions based in greed, hatred, and delusion. They stop, they cease. We don't create anything as a result of that. Stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all acquisitions or the bases for suffering, the clinging to body, the clinging to mind, that is the basis for suffering. So we relinquish that clinging to body and mind as something to possess, something to try and control, something to gain satisfaction from. We relinquish those as the bases for finding satisfaction, letting that go. The destruction of craving, the movement of the mind towards getting or getting away from, that constant surge and retreat of the mind. The destruction of craving, destruction of tanha, cessation or ceasing, nirodha, or the non-arising, cessation of dukkha, the cessation of becoming, has one flavor. As dukkha arises, we notice it. As dukkha ceases, we notice it. And then non-arising, when it's dukkha or becoming, when they're not arising, we know that. Nibbana, unbinding, coolness, complete and absolute peace. So this is the Dhamma that the Buddha taught also. This is the potential, this is the fruition that is possible. And just to reflect on that, wow, you know, that's enough to keep a person going through a difficult night. I'm finding a lot of enjoyment just bringing up these days. There's also different perceptions along those lines that can inspire and help settle the mind. And just the perceptions of, the three perceptions of anicca, dukkha, anatta. The Ajahn Jeff, I was recently reading, he makes a point of saying that actually they're more accurately described as perceptions rather than characteristics, that describing them as perceptions helps bring it into more of a practice mode, a kind of a strategic mode rather than a doctrinal mode. So bringing up those perceptions for reflection, consideration. I've been really particularly enjoying these days bringing up the perception, bringing up the recollection of anatta, just that sense of not me doing this, not me sitting, not me walking through the forest, body moving, thoughts thinking, mind moving, but just recollecting the teaching on not who I am. How peaceful that is, how settling that is. This is all part of the practice of, and the teaching of Dhamma. This is where we can take refuge, all the way from the smallest aspects of the training, the ways we move our body, the ways we eat, how we reflect on keeping the precepts, all the way to consideration, looking for inspiration in terms of the fruition, what's possible, all the way from the beginning, all the way to its completion. Taking refuge in Dhamma. Taking refuge in Sangha. People who are committed to the path, the practice. The fact that there have been many, many beings who have followed the path and who have taken it to completion. We can even recollect that we're very fortunate to know that there are at least a few beings currently alive who have completed their work. And not just to take refuge in their teachings, which of course is quite a wonderful thing in and of itself, but just the fact that it's possible in this current day. And to reflect on that, taking refuge in that, it's possible. And that we're working very hard, going through a lot of difficulties as we take on the teaching and the training, because there are other people out there who have done it, and we know it's possible. And taking refuge in the people around us who support us. You know, we stumble and we fall, and we've got each other to pick ourselves up. You know, often, you know, we try as best we can to pick ourselves up. That's the part of the training too. But we have Sangha to take refuge in, to help us when we need some help getting up, when we need a lift, we need a hand. Because part of our training in being here in this monastery is to do that. When you fall, I'll be there. One of the descriptions, one of the words, phrases that's used in some of the Sangha procedures to help with rehabilitation, it's called the getting up. So we trip, we stumble, and then we have the support of the training, we have the support of the Sangha to help lift, to get us back up on our feet over and over again, as many times as it takes, as long as we're sincere. And we want to keep training. And just accepting the fact that we make mistakes. You know, none of us has... I'm accurate in saying none of us have completely completed our work yet. So we're all going to fall, and we all need that, at least that moral support, that mutual support to stand up again, keep going, try again. Knowing that it can be done. So refuge in the Sangha. So we've got the triple gem. We've got the Buddha who discovered this, who taught it for so many years, who established it so clearly, who tirelessly, with great effort and great compassion, brought it into the world again. 2,500 years ago, here it is, still available. It's had that much of an impact that it's still available. Reflection, refuge in the Dhamma, the teaching, the Dhamma Vinaya, teaching and the discipline, the fullness of it, the complete path in its entirety as a livelihood, as a practice, as a way of life, and the support of beings who are making a commitment to follow it to completion. So just recollecting all of these to help inspire, to uplift, to provide a sense of reason for doing what we do, getting up, coming to pujas when we have them, coming to evening teachings, and walking the walk. So I think I'll leave it there for this evening's reflection.
Thank you.